Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Michelle LaVon Robinson, girl of the South Side. For the past 25 years, you have not only been my wife and mother of my children, you have been my best friend. You took on a role you didn't ask for, and you made it your own with grace and with grit and with style and good humor.
Welcome back to Politics. After an extended break for our mental health and to observe certain religious and non-denominal holidays, my name is Tim Batt and I'm from New Zealand.
Hello, Tim. My name is Jeb Lund and I am from both coasts of these great United States.
Is the word that I was looking for denominational or denominal? I think it's denominational.
Yeah,
we're off
yeah.
to a real flying start back to 2017. I feel like that's really setting the tone for what we can all expect, which is very little. But it's good to hear your voice, Jeb. It's great to have you back. Can I ask, before we dig back into the wasteland that is the American political landscape now, how was your break? How was your Christmas and your New Year's?
You know, it is a mixed bag. Right before Christmas, I went to New York for a couple of days to remind editors that I was flesh and blood and could be wounded and hurt, and that I was also unemployed. And I like to think that I did the Disney big eyes thing.
Oh, cool.
So hopefully that will have a salutary effect. And then I got sick. When I was there, it was supposed to be about 45 degrees. It wound up being about 33 the entire time I was there, and I got very ill and came home and I think gave it to my family and then had guests in the house for almost a week, and then got ill again.
Did you infect the guests?
I may have. The thing is, you know, when you have a small child, you can blame all of that on them.
Yeah, you're a good scapegoat. Very bad at fighting back. No one
They're
gives them any credibility
too.
They are moist little bacteria factories. Yeah. Well, that's not entirely positive, but
But I got to see family and I got to take a break, and of course I got to watch a little kid open presents, which is phenomenal. I mean, if you can just give you don't even really need to give them presents. If you give them wrapping paper and a brown, like a cardboard box, if they're, you know, a certain age, they're pretty much set as it is, and that was just a fantastic Christmas, and we don't really have Boxing Day, but my family just sort of sat around and opened up other things. So
nice. You got to take advantage of that while the kid's young enough, because they grow out of it real quick, and then they want very expensive licensed merchandise.
Yeah, I mean, they're like, buy me Bone Storm or go to hell.
And, yeah.
You know, I'm an unemployed writer. I can't buy them Bone Storm. I can get them a cup and ball thing.
Yeah,
but
nice.
What about you? What did you know? I understand it, you know, obviously because of the shape of the globe and how we revolve around the sun, that you obviously would not have had a white Christmas. It
Jeb,
was probably sweltering.
It's been great. We obviously had the election, your election, in early November, and everything went to pot. And even all my friends over here were quite depressed for a number of days, and we just walked around not really knowing what to do or say to each other. And then the sun shone, and then Christmas came up, and everything was great for a while, and we could forget about our troubles. And I went to the beach a lot, and saw some family, hung out with my partner's family, lots of beaches, lots of sunshine. It was wonderful. And now it feels like everything has come thick and fast back into focus. The real world is starting to turn again. And to beautifully use my radio skills that I plied my trade in for 5 years professionally before quitting, because they kept not giving me a pay rise above minimum wage, let's do a segue, which is, how sad was it being reminded of how cool Obama was at his farewell speech? I take it you've seen the farewell speech, you've dwelled on the farewell speech?
Yeah, I had that, you know, maybe other people have this sort of reaction too, where I was watching it and I thought I had all these clever and original thoughts about Obama. And then just to double check, I went back and looked at something I'd written before and realized that all of my clever and original thoughts were just the good parts of a pre-existing column. So I just sort of, yeah, I was like, well, I'm not going to write anything now. So I just sort of sat and enjoyed it. And, you know, the thing I had written was that, you know, it's so rare to get two naturally gifted orators as president, you know, within a basically a generation. And the Democratic Party, or really America in general, because obviously George W. Bush was not much of an orator, nor was his father. But, you know, the Democrats had Clinton and then Obama. And, you know, Clinton was able to personalize things, personalize policy to people in this amazing way. You know, I had this pathological need to convert a room.
Yeah.
You could be in a room and there'd be 100 people in the room who were on his side, and the 101st would be against him, and he would devote all his time to converting that guy, which is nutty but kind of amazing. And then Obama didn't do the granular policy thing, but he did the oratory and the aspiration and sort of yanked you upward into what you hoped America could be. And as I'd written in that column, and as I was feeling last night when I watched that farewell speech, I just kept thinking, I'm not going to see this again for a very long time.
Yeah, that is probably true due to how the pendulum swings, huh? Because whatever the answer is to Trump, it'll be like Trump's inverse, which I don't think is Obama-esque. Obama-esque is like a calming balm in the middle of the pendulum swing to just marry two completely disparate metaphors. But whatever comes next will be another firebrand, right, from the left. Is that a pretty reasonable expectation?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know who the I can't answer that question without looking at their bench, which is virtually non-existent.
Well, it's very old. The exciting figure, I mean, realistically, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, if you're saying the word firebrand and on the left, those are the two people who immediately come to mind. They're not, no spring chickens.
No, and Sanders will, you know, by every really plausible scenario, have aged out of the gig by 2020. So it's a matter of do the Republicans gut or hamstring the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau so much that there's nothing left for Warren to sit around and protect, and that with a relatively safe seat, if there's a decent, because there are a couple of up and coming Massachusetts politicians who could potentially take hers, then she could run. But after that, you've got O'Malley again, or
oh my god, that's such a scary thought. No, come on, surely there's even right now, even though I know that Trump hasn't been inaugurated, so we're really putting the cart before the horse here, but there's better than O'Malley. That was a joke, right, Jeb?
I feel like I have a column defending O'Malley, like somewhere in me, that I'm going to have to get to at some point. Because
I would love to hear that defense. But getting back to the speech, I absorbed a lot of it kind of audio only, because I was either playing the YouTube stream of it and kind of doing other things, or little bits got replayed on podcasts and things. But in particular, the one bit that I would highly recommend if you don't watch any of the rest of it is his address to Michelle. Is really sweet, man. It's really sweet. It's just a bit sad because we're going to be in such a different gear for at least the next 4 years. And he teared up. He pulled out a little hanky, wiped away some tears. And I mean, just such a model of this is a very clunky analogy because of recent news, but if you just took the television persona in the late 80s, like that Cosby's family of upstanding African-American, lovely marriage, like a lot of problems being thrown at them but working their way through sort of thing, it was just like this lovely vision of dignity. And then what's coming next is so tarnished that it was plausible that he had hired some Russian hookers to piss on a bed that the sitting president had slept in. We're going to get into that later. But
yeah,
that is a guy where it wasn't outside the realm of possibility that story could have been true.
I definitely have a lot of urine material I'd like to work on later. But what I liked about the Obama thing, and I've always liked about him and Michelle Obama, is if we are going to corporealize politics in these people, and you know, America is very good at that. We decide that we need to make our leaders our friends, and we have to admire them on an emotional level rather than just evaluating, do they have a good politics and do they execute it? And given the fact that we are so prone to that, I think we were very lucky to have the two of them, because when you see these farewell things where somebody thanks their wife, or when, you know, or maybe they're inaugurated and they thank their wife, it's almost like they're thanking just sort of a bric-a-brac. You know, there's not really an engagement with the person there.
Yeah.
Because for, you know, for so much of it, especially for conservatives, the wife is not supposed to be ever to outshine her husband. And the Obamas seemed fairly comfortable with, you know, Michelle having her own agenda and having something to do and having her own personality. And I know, you know, people who work in the White House who are constantly trying to badger her into doing things and being more of a political figure. And, you know, she was very adamant about, no, screw that. I'm not doing that. I don't enjoy doing that. You're not conning me into that, but I am interested in kids' health. And, you know, I am interested in going out and you know, promoting like the outreach aspect of the White House in a way that is my own. And so to see him say, thank you for coming on this journey with me, especially, you know, going back to knowing in 2008 that she was very reluctant to have him do it.
Yeah.
That actually meant something, because it was a, you know, I did have to ask permission because I valued your opinion so much that you could have said no.
Yes.
And the fact that you made the best of it and helped me in this way, great. And you know, that combined with all the White House photos over the years where they genuinely seem to really enjoy being around each other, and that was just very welcome. I mean, if we have to bring these people into our living rooms and equate politicians with friendship or acquaintanceship, I'm glad that we got, you know, something other than sort of the Potemkin household that you get with so many politicians.
Yeah, it was very sweet and very genuine and long lasting. And I can't imagine anything that would test your relationship more than the White House. One thing that I heard some people comment on, and I don't know because I haven't gone back and watched previous farewell speeches recently, or at all in many cases, of outgoing presidents. But one thing that was noted is that a lot of former presidents, as they leave, expressed out loud to the public what their regrets were over their term, and Obama didn't seem to do that. My take was that we probably, as the world, and you as Americans more specifically, kind of needed that. That was probably a mental calculation, that there's already so much shit coming down the pipe that you probably just needed the most rose-tinted positive version of events for right now, considering America's psyche. Would you agree with that, or do you think there's things that he could have highlighted and should have highlighted that didn't go to plan?
Well, so I saw a funny graphic, and no reason to believe it wasn't true, but it was number of times that Obama mentioned democracy, 20, and then, you know, number of times George W. Bush mentioned democracy in his farewell address, 1. Number of times Clinton said the word democracy, 0. You know, and kind of going back, and you know, Obama said it by far more than any other departing president in history. And so I think it's, you know, to kind of look at the two-part answer, the first part was that speech is really pretty much a rewritten version of a lot of his 08 stump speeches, his 2012 stump speeches. It's basically the Obama speech.
Yeah.
But if you kind of go down and to this, the sentence by sentence level and parse what he's doing, it was, let me buck up your faith in the American experiment and your ability to be the thing that changes America, versus Trump saying at the RNC, I am your voice, I'm the one who can fix things. And it was by invoking democracy and the power of crowds working together, no matter how small the stature of people in them, I think it was this long subtweet rejection of authoritarianism.
Absolutely.
And so that was, you know, kind of like what you're saying, that's what people needed. And I think maybe where he didn't address his failings, might have been a calculation of, I don't want you to be bummed out right now. You need to buck up. And you know, everybody can litigate what I did wrong later. I mean, there were certain things where, for, you know, he tried to like stovepipe talking about free markets in things that ISIS hated. And you're like, okay, I don't know what that is. And he talked about, you know, what, trying to close Guantanamo. Like, I mean, if you really wanted to, you know, we could have done a lot more on that. And, you know, he invoked the importance of unions. And one of the first things the Obama administration did was they took card check and said, fuck it, we don't care. And like every Democratic president of my lifetime, like, we really care about unions. We're not going to do anything for unions. And then we're going to wonder why our get out the vote ability diminishes every 4 years. But
hey, real quick, what's card check? Explain that to me briefly.
So card check was basically a way of certifying unions more easily, because you basically, if you've got a shop of people and you want to organize, if you just get like 50% of them to kind of vote for, we want to be in a union, you don't have to go through this longer certification process. And basically, because the Republican Party has done such a good job of hamstringing unions, this was thought to be a way of like, we can more rapidly expand unionization and try to get it back to, you know, it would take a very long time to get it back to the post-war state of America, but at least halt the withering power of unions. And it was something that, you know, the unions backed Obama, and they were really hoping for, and it just sort of disappeared. And in that, like, well, it's not feasible. We have to do the stimulus. We have to do healthcare.
Right.
And it's one of those things that's aggravating if you are worried about the Democratic Party's capacity to get out the vote in off years, and also to, you know, expand its sort of activist base, because one of the, you know, the power for getting out the vote that the Democratic Party used to have was union power.
Yeah.
Because you get shop leaders who marched people out to the polls in the same way that, you know, black preachers do souls to the polls. You show up at our meeting, hey, guess what? We're all going to go vote now. And so while it's disappointing at the time, the effects are felt down the line, because having that organizing capacity helps you in the off year and helps you in contested elections, and also helps you with the working class, which the Democratic Party hasn't been so good at doing things for. And so this was another thing that they didn't do. And Obama just sort of invoking the importance of organized labor was great. And I think he mainly meant it as a kind of reminder of what we need to push back against during the Trump years.
Yeah.
But it was also a reminder of how you don't hear about the value of labor out of the Democratic Party, really, except for every 4 years. And labor certainly notices that, which is why a lot of those people voted for Donald Trump.
So in closing for this first segment of the podcast today, Jeb, what would you give out of 10 for Obama's farewell speech?
Oh, man. Like, if you'd never heard it before, I mean, like a 9. If you have heard it before, I mean, and this is weighted against the sort of normal caliber of American oratory, you know, an easy 7.
Is that against you? Obama, or against sort of all American presidents?
Well, I mean, against Obama, because he's hit bigger heights, and because he was recycling so much material. I mean, there were so many standard Obama tropes, and given the severity of what's going on, maybe he could have deviated from hope a little bit, and you have the power to create change, and maybe talk a little bit more about, I know personally, a lot of people I know were upset that he didn't address pragmatic ways to, for average citizens to get involved. He said, you know, go out and get a clipboard. Well, I mean, you gotta find somebody to give you the clipboard and tell you which houses to knock on.
But I mean, come on, man. I would definitely push back against those pals of yours, because it's a president's farewell address. You know, you get the top line item, you go and you Google it. He didn't need to have a 5-step program in there. He's trying to cover a lot of stuff. I myself am probably in line with you. I would give it a high 8, I reckon, overall. Some good takeaway tips. Talk to internet people in real life. It'll do wonders. Yeah. I thought that was nice. And the aforementioned outpouring of emotion when he was, you know, as much as Barack Obama does in public, for Michelle, I thought that was great, and a lot of like good messages and stuff, but it was kind of standard fare, and I think the bar is just set so high for him that it's sort of hard to be constantly impressed with his skills at this point. we're going to wrap up. We'll be back in just a tick to talk about, what is our next thing that we're talking about, Jeb? It's Trump's first press conference. Sounds like the worst storybook you could buy for your kid, huh?
For all the talk lately about fake news, this political witch hunt by some in the media is based on some of the most flimsy reporting, and it's frankly shameful and disgraceful. With that, it is my honor to introduce the next Vice President of the United States, Mike Pence.
So earlier today, President-elect Donald Trump gave his first press conference in, it's like 160-something days, I think, and really came out swinging. Oh boy, he was mad as a hopper. He opened up, I think, really well by finding, and again, when I say really well, I'm comparing this to the bar that I've set in my head of Trump. He found a conciliatory note that he could bring to the press by saying, thank you very much to those of you who did not carry a story about me hiring Russian prostitutes and pissing in a bed. You guys rule, okay by me. And then as the press conference progressed, that goodwill seemed to be eroded in record time. What was your initial thoughts after you saw that first press conference of your incoming president, Jeb?
So many people use this sort of language on Twitter, especially journalists who all seem to, not all, but there's a really goodly contingent that all seem to feel like they're running for the fainting couches at every moment, especially the people who feel that they're the sort of the unappointed stewards of the Republic. But that ended with my feeling genuinely horrified.
Oh, God, that's not good. So, okay, let's drill down into this. I'm going to be your armchair psychologist for a tick, Jeb. What was it specifically that made you feel, what was your word, terrified?
Well, horrified. But yeah, like he had staffers there to applaud. Okay, two things. Like his staffers were ringing the press, so they were behind them, which is pretty much the same setup he had when he used to, when he did his arena shows. He would put the press right in front of his fans, like sort of the right in front of the front row, so they had 10,000 Trump fans at their back when Trump said, these are evil people who lie about me. And it's this cheap intimidation tactic. He did it again, so he and then he had his staffers clap and make noise when he demonized the press. He started shouting at CNN that they're fake news. CNN misreports things. All outlets misreport things. Everybody gets stuff wrong. But he, like a lot of right-wing things, he took something that the left-wing got all keyed up about and that the left-wing created as an item of the discourse, in this case, fake news, and said, well, I can use that against you better than you can use it against me. So he's shouting down Jim Acosta, and he's not going to answer him. And Acosta apparently at the end of it gets threatened with, you know, if you do that kind of unprofessional, abusive thing and you don't apologize, you're not going to be available. You know, we're going to kick you out of all future press conferences. He's doing his job.
Apologize? Jesus.
Yeah, Sean Spicer. Oh, that was the other. Sean Spicer came out and I mean, with the demeanor of a fucking pit bull, you know, starts excoriating the media. And I mean, like Ron Ziegler on PCP, you know, after like a 3-day bender, that kind of anger.
It was someone's high school principal who has been at the school for 40 years and he has enjoyed not a day of it. And he just came out there to brutalize the press. It was such a weird tone to kick off on. And then he had to, and he didn't, he kind of like, he was just mad about all this Russia stuff that had been going on the last 24, 48 hours. And then just brought Mike Pence into that. He was just like, I'm fucking pissed off. I'm furious at you guys. You're done goofed. Here's Mike Pence. And Mike Pence always wants to kind of put on a brave face and be this forward looking, kind of positive talking dude. And it speaks volumes about the staff that he's surrounded himself in that I'm feeling bad for Mike Pence whenever I see him now. That's weird, but also true.
Yeah, I kind of feel that way too. I always hate when I feel sympathy for the devil, you know, but But so that too was just ludicrous, right? Even when he's doing a press conference as president of elect of the United States, he still can't get his mind out of essentially basic cable stagecraft.
Yeah.
So it's like a roast. They've got a big table up there, and they've got all of his people on the left, kind of hanging back on a dais, right? And then Sean Spicer comes out and introduces him. Then his attorney comes out and does, which is, I mean, a great look, right? When you're the president of the United States, the first thing your attorney does is come out and go, listen, this guy isn't crooked. And then Pence comes out.
Do you know, credit, and, sorry to interrupt you, but credit to them, that needed to be done, I think. I do not begrudge him. I can't remember what all the folders and paperwork were. I think someone missed a line that they were supposed to explain it, and then he came on later and said, I don't think this was explained very well before, but I think he was suggesting it was all the paperwork to divest him of all the really bad stuff. Well, not divest, but get sort of arm's length from the investments that would hypothetically trip him up in office.
He said, you know, by the way, this is the paperwork for all my properties. I'm not even sure it was the divestiture or divestment paperwork. It was just here's all the stuff I own. And then when reporters went up to try to look at the folders, the Trump people went up and swatted their hands away. So, I mean, there could have been invitations to a fucking quinceañera in there and nobody would know. I mean, it could have been the novel that Jack Torrance is writing in The Shining. But you've got the whole, like, and even that too is like the stagecraft of a drug bust. Like, look how much cocaine we got.
Yeah, yeah. But it's all, fuck, this is so tricky, eh? Like, figuring out what to measure this incoming administration against. It's like, those were issues that needed to be addressed, right? And this is the way that they chose to do it. This is kind of within the tenor of how he campaigned and he won the election. So there is a understandability about, you know, continuing that path that he's walked, which has got him to victory. It's a hot issue that really needs to be dealt with immediately. The Republicans recently got scorched in record time on social media in particular, because they were trying to defang the ethics committee. Is that right, Jeb? Which are like an oversight group that would be kind of looking into all of these incoming people, their connections, their business interests, what future decisions would mean for their own personal enrichment. And when that bill was introduced, people fucking...
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Noticed. Huffington Post did a piece about it immediately. It got round, and Paul Ryan, who I think wasn't told that the bill was going to be put forward immediately, was trying to warn them to just keep it quiet and not do it, if for no other reason than timing. And lo and behold, his prophecy came true, and everyone was terrified about it. But so it was ultimately unsuccessful. But it does go to show me that it was something that needed to be addressed. This was their way of doing it. So that's kind of
and like it doesn't address anything at all, right? And it's a classic Trump move where, you know, his attorney at any moment in the last month could have scheduled her own press conference and given copies of this documentation to the press and done a Q&A and not involve Trump. Instead, he comes out with the the seized assets table like a drug bust, and the attorney gives an explanation and he says, well, listen, I'm turning over control of my company to my sons, but I'm not going to have any contact with them and I'm going to divest myself. This is bullshit. It's a non-explanation. It's never going to happen. It's still massively unethical. This is not a blind trust. This is, you know, no part of this arrangement is acceptable whatsoever.
But it's pretty crazy that it's, I think he's learned a really important lesson, and it almost seems tiresome to point this out again because so many people have been commenting on it for so long now, breathlessly, but I don't want to say post-truth, but it's this age that we're living in, where if you do repeat something enough times, like, people will either just be so exhausted or overwhelmed by the dump truck of messaging that you're giving them that it kind of overloads common sense. The fact that he, do you know, the mental image that kept coming to me when he referred to his two sons was Saddam Hussein. I was like, yeah. Oh, here's Hussein and Uday, with their names?
Uday and Kusei.
Kusei, sorry. And I was like, shit, man, this is like a direct, I'm getting flashes in my mind as you're up there on stage. You suddenly have this big, bushy Middle Eastern moustache. It was real crazy. And the fact that he's presenting this stuff as that it would be perfectly normal, saying that he won't be having conversations with his children who will be running his businesses while he's there, as if like that just fixes all the problems. But the thing is that he's, this isn't admiration for him, but it's more just fascination with the phenomenon of it, that he's not changing. He, in the face of overwhelming common sense, he's not buckling whatsoever. He's just like, no, this is fine. This will be sweet. I'm going to keep repeating this line, which I've been trotting out for months now, that my kids will be my equivalent of a blind trust, and we just won't talk about it when we get together. And it's so crazy that he hasn't wavered from it. But this is how he's going to do stuff. It's real freaky, man. It's like a different take on what reality is.
Well, it hasn't misserved him yet. You know, he's been claiming to be a successful real estate mogul in spite of multiple bankruptcies and constant failure for nearly 40 years. And the press just pretty much reports that. I mean, the serious press says Donald Trump is bankrupt and a fraud. Mm. But the entertainment press has always covered him. He's always been on TV and radio. And so he's always had this direct access to people who want to be entertained and who are fascinated with rich people and who don't notice the unsettling connection between the fact that the only two people I can think of who had a solid gold toilet everywhere they shit was Saddam Hussein and Donald Trump.
So let me ask you this. When does the watermark get so high that he has to adjust there? Like, what is a force great enough to make him steer off course of what he's been doing so far? Is it going to take impeachment proceedings? Is it going to take public polls going down for him and his popularity? Like, what do you think will be the thing? Or do you think that this is sustainable and this is what it's going to be like for the next 3 to 4 years?
I think this is just it. Okay, for a couple of reasons. One, the only thing that really seems to thwart him is sudden imposition of poverty, which he's not going to get because, you know, he and his family are just going to do some massively corrupt shit and enrich themselves. And two, like, massive unpopularity. But the people that like him are so dedicated and they vote in greater percentage than everyone else. And he just won an election and control of both houses of Congress. So, you know, he has no incentive to change. I mean, he's got a only 37 or 35% approval rating, which is a historic low for the United States. But it doesn't matter because every single one of those people voted, basically. Yeah. And I think he's going to have people like Steve Bannon and Reince Priebus saying, look, you know, even if you do stuff that pisses off a lot of people, in the, you know, Republicans are favored in off-year elections, and even if they look like they're in trouble, what they'll do is they'll just run against you and say, we're not Donald Trump. They're, you know, in most of them, especially in their House, or sorry, not especially in the House, are in heavily gerrymandered districts where basically they have to worry more about their primary than anything and being out, you know, being outdone in terms of extremism. Yeah. So they can always just turn against him and then get reelected and go right back to doing the same shit. It really, you know, like, I think kind of like Hussein, it's going to end when somebody slaps the cuffs on him or maybe at the end of the term.
Damn, that's bleak. You don't think that even if it's not something that can force him to make the mental or emotional shift himself to change how he's presenting himself, do you think that there is a big enough external force that would force it upon him as an imposition? Maybe, that is realistic. I mean, impeachment.
if you look at, so impeachment, and if you look at his, or, you know, violence, but if you look at his history, I mean, the stuff he responds to is being unpopular. So if you had mass regular demonstrations that showed that he is overwhelmingly loathed, and if you could do this in places outside of, you know, you look at the Trump campaign and they're like, well, you know, it would have been a landslide for
if
Trump,
we take away all of the coasts.
Yeah. Well,
no coasts anymore.
You know what I mean? Like, you know, if we had, you know, if we had steak and ale, you know, we could have steak and ale if we had steak and ale. I mean, if, fine, you know. But, you know, if you actually did have people in red America throwing shit at him, you know, if his car is getting pelted with eggs, if people, you know, call him a scum-sucking son of a bitch, if, you know, little old housewives are telling him to go fuck himself, maybe.
Yeah, and I think that that's probably the most unrealistic situation of all, because people have got to get on with their goddamn lives at some point. Like, it is all very well and good for people to engage in an election year or in an election season with some of the events that are going on, but people got shit to do. They've got kids to try and find some money to send them to college. They've got to pay their bills. They've got to try and hold on to their jobs and stuff. Like, there's only so long, I think, that American citizens can hold on to that rightful rage and indignation for and put it somewhere before it just kind of, it has to go lower down the list in the regular course of life. The only thing I can think that would change that is if there's some interesting application of technology where you get something that is as easy as change.org but actually has some effect in the real world to represent people. But I have, my imagination can't even stretch into what the possibility of that could be.
I think you're right. You know, especially now that, you know, our economic recovery has all been in crappy temp and service jobs, and we've converted an economy of people with salaries and pensions and overtime to people who, you know, take their machinist expertise to work at Home Depot and then at Subway.
And then
yeah,
Uber.
You know, and those people can't go out and protest because if you're working, if your wage is hourly, you can't go out. On the other hand, he's going to create a lot of unemployed people, and unemployed people are really good at showing up to protests because they've got nowhere else to go.
I hope you're right. Let's end that piece of this episode there, and we're going to come right back and explain what a golden shower is to you. You probably already know if you listen to this podcast.
And what I'm going to be doing is my two sons, who are right here, Don and Eric, are going to be running the company. They are going to be running it in a very professional manner. They're not going to discuss it with me.
Welcome back to Politics with two men who are about to talk about sex workers urinating on beds. Because it's not every day that hashtag golden showers is trending on Twitter. But it was yesterday, Jeb. It was an exciting time. And the reason for that, which some people will have been able to hide their ears from, is there was a dossier which apparently has been doing the rounds among certain members of the Washington Press and Washington people, like John McCain and some others, since October, which was a collection of evidence supposedly accrued by the intelligence community. It's been leaked. It got leaked yesterday, and part of the dossier is a report which alleges that Donald Trump hired two Russian prostitutes in the Ritz-Carlton in Moscow on a trip that he took there to urinate in a bed that Barack and Michelle Obama slept in. Have I got that right so far, Jeb? You interjecting with something?
I think it may have been more than two. I don't want to sell them short. I mean, especially if you're going to do a golden shower party. I mean, I don't know why you would. I think if you had that money and you really wanted to file that bed,
yeah,
I would start at six prostitutes.
See, that's the difference between you and me, Jeb, because I don't think they mentioned a number. And in my head, I just somewhere automatically went, it's two prostitutes. You think bigger than me. You got bigger goals, and I respect that about you. But
also, I really hope that it's somewhere. You know, like, I hope that I have an impact on someone's life enough that maybe they change their text notification on their phone to my saying, I would start with six prostitutes. But
that's a pretty great way to get an SMS from your mom. So this is the allegation. And look, it is full of holes and it's also unverified. And I mean, on the balance of evidence, it's probably most likely untrue. Let's start there. Would you agree with that sentiment so far, Jeb?
I would believe that he would want to defile a bed that the Obamas had been in. I think he has a really, really malignant fixation on them. No part of that story, like that he would just have a golden shower party, surprises me. I don't think it's... I don't know. Like, I guess what I'm saying is, like, it wouldn't surprise me if it were 100% real or 100% fake. It's perfectly within the realm of possibility for both.
There is kind of like a lot of ways to slice this thing up. From the journalistic point of view, BuzzFeed News were the ones who published this, and the supposed dossier has been in the hands of multiple press agencies for quite some time who have not acted on it. They haven't brought it forward because the facts have been impossible to verify so far. There's an allegation that the Russians have a recording of this event because they had bugged Trump's hotel room. So according to this thing, which has got a lot of holes in it, it's got spelling mistakes. There are people and dates that are referred to which can't possibly match up, who are some of Trump's people that were in America at the time and hadn't left the country during the time period that they're talking about them being overseas in Russia. So there's, like on the balance of things, it's probably not true. And there is definitely a lot of discussions that rightly are happening at the moment about should BuzzFeed have released this thing? What was the utility of it? Like, where is the line? Where is the public interest bit? I'm not a journalist. I don't know. You're a journalist, Jeb, ostensibly. What's your take in terms of the release, first off?
I think if somebody had released something like this about Hillary Clinton, you know, just this made up... I mean, because you look at that dossier, right? And so much of it is stuff that you already knew. I mean, Paul Manafort was clearly intervening in Ukraine with, you know, the interests of Russia. Other, you know, Trump advisors had ties to pro-Russian elements in Ukraine, or just, you know, actual representatives of Russia. That's not, you know, that wasn't a huge stretch. Hillary Clinton's campaign manager, Podesta, and the Podesta group, I think is the term, had ties to pro-Russian forces in Ukraine, if I'm not mistaken. You know, certainly, like, there was that sort of avenue of well, that's a bit hypocritical when everyone who was basically in the tank for the DNC went after Manafort. It's like, well, you know,
we're
going to do consultant clients. But you know, you have these little elements of truth, and then you have these sort of salacious bits, and then they're all kind of like gel together in this not very, you know, coherent or professional way. And, you know, it could be real and just a hastily made thing or something that's been transferred or rewritten, or it's Piltdown Man, you know, where you got a couple of fossils that are real and somebody sort of glues them together to create a fake missing link. If BuzzFeed or somebody else had done it about the left would absolutely howl. It's opportunistic for them to latch onto this. BuzzFeed's rationale was that it's out there and then people can make up their own mind. But I don't know how anybody collects information enough to dispute the veracity of this independently. Most of the debunking that people are experiencing are professional news services that are doing it. And many of those professional news services were offered this document before and turned it down. I mean, you could watch representatives of other publications going, you know, hey, you know, raise your hand if you passed on this.
So one of the things that has been rolling around in my mind, which I mentioned earlier, is the fact that how damaged is your credibility with the public that this story could be believed? But now that I'm thinking about it, maybe we're just in a time where, like, kind of anything's believable because it's fun about anyone. So maybe that doesn't have the strength that I initially thought. But it did kind of occur to me that even if the whole thing is an entire fabrication, and there, I will note as well that there are some claims from a lot of people on 4chan that one of their posters basically made this thing up and then passed it along. I haven't seen compelling evidence that proves that yet, but it would be
it's absolute bullshit.
Damn it, because that would be hilarious to me if true. very, very funny if 4chan managed to pull that off.
It would make no sense. I mean, though, that's the big thing, is that, you know, they think that they've elected God Emperor Trump via this meme offensive online. So why would you then create a dossier that is plausible enough that you could get the intelligence community and Never Trumpers to bite on it and then impugn Donald Trump?
Because it's not one guy and it's not one organization, you know? It's like anonymous. Although anonymous it's almost like just a punchline now if you say it out loud. But 4chan is just a collection of anonymous posters online, who a lot of whom just want to have a giggle and see how much impact they can have online. They'll just troll in any direction possible. So I don't know if I quite buy that rationale of that they were one cohesive unit that thinks at least that they got him into the White House and that would insulate them from any blame of doing things to damage him in the future. I think their biggest friend will always be just getting the biggest laugh possible on the biggest public stage. So from that point of view, I definitely think it could have been them. But I just haven't seen any evidence that there was a previous posting with dates or anything.
Well, I can tell you, I mean, so that original post was made in early November, and it was the day after, if not quite literally the day after, then maybe like 2 days after, David Korn in Mother Jones had written about some of these rumors and accusations that have been going on. And then they said, well, you know, this paid off. We actually just gave all that information to Rick Wilson, who's a Republican, Never Trump commentator. And like, how you get Rick Wilson passing intelligence information, you know, up the chain to intelligence agencies who then vet it, that's not going to happen. You know, the CIA isn't going to go like, oh, Rick Wilson called with a story about Donald Trump and prostitutes. We're definitely going to check this. No, I mean,
the version I heard from Rick Wilson to John McCain's office, and John McCain got it into the intelligence community. But I'm not saying that's just the version I heard.
Don't believe it's fucking stupid. Like, this would never work. Like, don't believe it and don't give him any more ammo. And I mean, it would be if they had come up with this point, that if somebody had posted this on 4chan the day before the Mother Jones article, you know, I would think that's great. But it's clearly somebody read that and went, it's not enough in the mainstream enough that I could plausibly pretend that I had massaged this info and given it to the right person. But you and I could like claim that we were responsible for the events of yesterday.
As
long as we wake up with today's newspaper.
Yeah. Which would make a hell of a TV show. And it did for a few seasons, and there was a great cat involved. Do you think
Kyle Chandler of Friday Night Lights, right? Early edition, wasn't that?
Got it. Early edition. Yes. Not a lot of people remember that. What do you think, that it's a net kind of positive or negative, this whole thing, how it's playing out so far for the Trump camp? Do you think this is going to work for them?
I think this is one of those things where if you are a Trump fan, the fact that he can trash a Ritz-Carlton with a bunch of prostitutes just makes him seem more balls out awesome. And if you don't like Donald Trump, this just confirms that you had another reason not to like him, unless you're really into water sports. And I mean, God bless you if you are. But I don't really see how it changes the conversation, except for like potentially, and this would be the aim, if you want to believe that the intelligence community is biting back at him, that it's just plausible enough that he has to sweat it, and it gets journalists going, okay, we need to dogpile this information and ferret out the real stuff. And that works if you know that there's real stuff there. And what you're trying to do is draw the attention of journalists who otherwise might be distracted from the outlandish and tacky things that he's doing, and not keeping their eyes on the prize. That would be your reason for doing it. But it itself isn't going to hurt him unless it leads to something down the line. And we're going to have to wait, you know, a couple weeks, a month to figure that out.
And just to be clear, the theory with that is, because Trump has been hitting out against the intelligence community with a lot of comments he's been making, this was retribution, that this dossier was released by someone in the intelligence community to the press. It was leaked to them intentionally to bite back at Trump. And it's the relationship that he is forging right now with the intelligence community is going to be one of the things I'm most interested in watching develop. And it's just so scary, because it's such a powerful apparatus, and the US intelligence community always scares me. It scares me when they are on side with the president, but that's what's supposed to happen, right? It's supposed to be a tool in his arsenal so that he can make correct assessments and instigate particular kinds of warfare against enemies. But when they are not in tandem, when they're not on the same page, when they are quarreling with each other, like, I don't know what the effect of that is, but I'm willing to bet it's probably something even scarier. I guess it's a devil you know kind of a situation, but the chaotic relationship of this super powerful network of intelligence members with all of this technology and finance and resource to really, really mess shit up in any direction that they want to, not getting on with the highest office in the land, is like, it's scary to me. How do you feel about it as an American, this out of step relationship that they've got at the moment?
Well, I mean, I was a history student, so my experience with the CIA is usually they're destabilizing a perfectly normal, lawfully elected democratic regime, usually because the United Fruit Company is upset.
Yeah, but not at so, home.
Yeah. So that's, but I mean, this is how you get, you know, this is how you wind up becoming Turkey, you know, where you have elected leaders, and then periodically the military comes in and goes, no, this guy doesn't count. We're going to have a do-over. So that is a third option, you know, I guess from your question earlier, is he going to be impeached or ride out his term? I mean, the third option would be
coup town.
Sometimes some kind of coup, but I don't know. I mean, if you do that, I mean, you know, America's done. You're not going back to normal after that. So I kind of, you know, I really don't want that to happen.
I was listening to the 538 Politics podcast, Nate Silver and his staff talking about this. And he said, you know, I was thinking about this today, and America's had a good run. We were celebrating the 10th anniversary of the iPod today, and I recently did a trip to Rome, and I was thinking about the rise and fall of empires. Imagine if the iPod was kind of the pinnacle of our civilization. That's not such a bad run. It's like, yeah, Jesus, yeah. Christ, man, that's pretty bleak coming from a professional statistician. If that's where your head's at.
You could be England, right? You know, like the high point of your empire could be textile mills that maimed and deformed women, and coal, and not being able to, you know, people dying of breathing the air in London, and dreadnoughts that you launched and then that did fuck all in the First World War. I mean, that could be your apex. At least with the iPod, the iPhone, you can look at pornography wherever you are.
True words have never been spoken, and I think that is just the kind of tone I want to end this first back into 2017 episode on. Jeb, thank you very much for talking to me. We're going to keep doing this. We're sorry there was a big gap, but we needed to recover ourselves. And we're also trying to think about how to make this thing actually sustainable. So we're going to try and chase down a sponsor. Maybe you represent a large corporation that would like to throw money at us. Probably not, because I don't think they exist. But another method that we're thinking about is Patreon, whereby you lovely people out there listening, some of you who are well endowed, would give us a couple of bucks and we would provide some bonus content and stuff. So we would love to hear your thoughts. If you have anything that you want to hear from us that would serve as bonus content, send it on through. Go to the Facebook page for Politics. Leave us a comment or send us a message if you don't want it to be public. That's fine too. Give us some suggestions on what you think would be worthwhile, and we will read all of them. Jeb, any closing thoughts apart from pornography everywhere is definitely the apex of American civilization?
Well, I was trying to bring it back to golden showers, and then you just cut me off right there and then went to the end. So like, I was doing a callback, but no, like I think on the matter of sponsors, like if you're a company with a heavily secured campus around Virginia or Maryland, and you work in communications, anything that we said about the president or about the intelligence community that it could be taken askance, we didn't mean. But
it's all a joke.
We understand that you have deep pockets, and honestly, the content of this show can change like that.
I'm backing that. What Jeb just said, I second that as my final thoughts. Not only can we be bought and paid for, we can be bought and paid for surprisingly cheaply. So just think about that. Thanks for listening, everybody. Goodbye, Jeb.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Sir, since you're attacking us, can you give us a question? Mr. President-elect.
Go ahead.
Mr. President-elect, since you are attacking our news organization, can you give us a chance?
Your organization.
You are attacking our news organization. Can you give us a chance to ask a question, sir?
Go ahead.
Sir, can you state, Mr. President-elect, can you state categorically, Mr. President-elect, can you give us a question? You're attacking us. Can you give us a question?
Don't be rude.
Can you give us a question?
I'm not going to give you a question.
Can you state categorically?
You are fake news.
Sir, can you state categorically that nobody, no, Mr. President-elect, that's not appropriate.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.